Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting of the Housing Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Houseman?
Present.
Howard?
Present.
Tice? Tice?
Present.
Thank you. Big Badger?
Present.
Bliss? Bliss. Gomez.
Present.
Hassan.
Present.
Heinrich.
Heinrich present.
Her. Her. Juergens.
Juergens present.
Olson. Olson. Barr.
Barr present.
And Ryer.
Present.
Madam Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you. The next order of business is approval of the minutes from Thursday, March 25. Representative Howard, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
Representative Howard moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? If not, members, if you would unmute yourselves for a voice vote. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, today we have House File 1077, which is our committee budget bill. For the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. For today's meeting, we'll have a rollout of the bill. We'll have an overview from our fiscal analyst, Ken Savory, and we have two House researchers, Mary Mullen and Chelsea Griffin. So today the point is to take clarifying questions and technical questions for nonpartisan staff. We always respect their need to be a nonpartisan and a bipartisan. We'll take clarifying and technical questions at the conclusion of each article. So today's meeting is intended to make sure all members and the public have a thorough understanding of the contents of the omnibus bill. And tomorrow's meeting will be for public testimony and consideration of amendments. There's a 5 o'clock deadline for amendments this afternoon. And included in your meeting packets are three documents, the DE1 amendment, which is gets the bill before us, housing finance spreadsheet to the DE1, and then a House research summary on House File 1077. So we will then begin with our nonpartisan staff walkthrough, beginning with the spreadsheet overview. Ken Savory, fiscal analyst. Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, good morning for the tape. My name is Ken Savory, House fiscal staff. I'll be going through the spreadsheet, as the chair mentioned, that was included in member packets and posted on the committee website by the committee administrator. I'll start just by kind of laying the groundwork in terms of which columns we'll be looking at today. The columns labeled K, L, M, and N are columns related to the DE1 amendment for House File 1077. I'll begin on line 7, which are the appropriations in the bill. Line 7 is the challenge program. The bill appropriates, or the DE appropriates, $18,925,000 in fiscal year 22 and $12,925,000 in fiscal year 23. That's the $6 million one-time increase from the base budget. Next is line 8, the Workforce Housing Development Program. The DE appropriates $2 million in each year. And those that is the base appropriation. There is no change. Line 9 is the manufactured home park infrastructure grants. The first fiscal year is $3 million, and the second fiscal year is $1 million. That is a $2 million one-time increase for that particular program. Line 10 is the workforce home ownership program. The DE appropriates $2 million in the first year and $2 million in the second year. That's a $3.5 million increase in the FY22-23 biennium. Additionally, the bill appropriates $750,000 in each year in the tails, which is a $1 million increase from the base in the tails. Line 11 is the Housing Trust Fund. The Housing Trust Fund is funded at the base level and remains unchanged at $11.646 million per year. Line 12 is the Rental Assistance for Mobile Students, or the Hallmark Starts with Home program. The bill appropriates $2,250,000 in each fiscal year, which is a $1 million increase from the base. Line 13 is the Rental Assistance for the Mentally Ill, or the Bridges program. The bill appropriates $5,088,000 in each fiscal year, which is a $1.5 million increase from the base in FY22-23 and also in the tails. Line 14 is the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. The bill appropriates the base amount for the program, which is $10,269,000 in each fiscal year. Line 15 is the Affordable Rental Investment Fund. The bill appropriates $4,218,000 in each fiscal year, and that is the base appropriation. Line 16 is the Housing Rehabilitation, the owner-occupy portion, which is $2.772 million per year. That is unchanged from the base. Line 17 is the Rental Housing Rehabilitation Program. That is $3.743 million per year, and that is unchanged from the base. Line 18 is the Homeownership Assistance Fund. That is $4,385,000 in the first year and $885,000 in the second year. The first year increase is a $3.5 million one-time increase over the base. Line 19 is the Homeownership Education Counseling and Training Program, or HECAT, is a one-time increase in the first year. The first year is $1.357 million. And that is a $500,000 increase in the first year. Line 20 are the capacity building grants. These are funded at the base level of $645,000 each fiscal year. Line 21 is the Homelessness Management Information System. The bracketed amount of $125,000 is a carve out of the capacity building grants in the above line. That appropriation or carve out remains unchanged from the base. Line 22 is the Build Wealth and Men Family Stabilization Plan. That is $500,000 in each fiscal year, and that is unchanged from the base. The remaining appropriations are new programs in the DE. Line 23 is the Local Housing Trust Fund grants. That's a $3 million one-time appropriation in the first year. Line 24 is the Natural Occurring Affordable Housing Preservation Appropriation. That is $6,545,000, a one-time appropriation in fiscal year 22. Line 25 is the LED Safe Homes Program. That's $1 million appropriation in each year in the FY22-23 biennium. And then the appropriation decreases slightly to $750,000 in each fiscal year in the outline biennium. And then finally, line 26 is the Shelter Provider Task Force. That's funded at a one-time appropriation of $455,000. Other items on the spreadsheet are the change items. So the changes I just listed off are listed on lines 28 to line 43, and the total changes are on line 44. Line 47 is the total appropriations within the housing DE. The first year appropriates $83,798,000. And the second year appropriates $61,798,000 for a total of $145,596,000. Additionally, language within the bill on lines of spreadsheet 49 and 52 refer to House File 203, which was the housing pool return application deposit. This is the information from the fiscal note. Members would recall that the committee heard testimony on this bill earlier in the year. And Madam Chair, that concludes the walkthrough of the DE amendment spreadsheet.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. Are there any clarifying questions for Mr. Savory? Mr. Wirth, I don't see any hands. Am I missing anyone?
Madam Chair, there are no hands up.
Okay, then in that case, we'll proceed with the House Research overview of the DE1. We have Chelsea Griffin and Mary Mullen from House Research, and I believe we're starting with Ms. Griffin for the overview of Article 1. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Thank you. Please proceed.
All right, well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Chelsea Griffin, and I'm with House Research. I'll be walking you through Articles 2 through 5 of the DE amendment, being that Mr. Savory has already gone over the appropriations that are in Article 1. I will note that the summary for the DE amendment does articulate where the various appropriations are located. So Article 2 is the Housing Grant Programs article. It contains amendments to various housing programs that are administered by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, which I'll refer to as MHFA. Section 1 eliminates the limitation on rehabilitation loans that prohibits such a loan to be made in an amount that would exceed 110% of a property's market value. Section 2 authorizes MHFA to make rehabilitation loans for the purpose of replacement of manufactured homes. This section also increases the maximum loan amount to $35,000. Section 3 requires MHFA to impose rent and or income restrictions on a multifamily rental housing development as a condition of agency financing or of an allocation or award of federal low-income housing tax credits. Section 4 establishes a new LEDSafe Homes grant program in MHFA to make grants to nonprofit organizations and political subdivisions to provide lead testing and lead hazard reduction in rental housing. Section 5 clarifies that the debt ceiling relates to general obligation bonds and notes which are outstanding at any time. Section 6 amends housing infrastructure bond definitions. So the definition of housing infrastructure bond is amended to eliminate bonds that finance the construction or rehabilitation of single family houses that qualify for mortgage revenue bond financing. And there is a newly defined term of senior household, and the a definition of senior is accordingly amended. Section 7 eliminates a reviewed accessibility service plan from the list of preferential proposal criteria for senior housing. Section 8 increases the maximum grant or loan amount for workforce housing projects to 50% of the rental housing development project cost. And Section 9 establishes a task force on shelter right, resident rights and shelter provider practices and requires a report to the legislature on specified findings and recommendations. Madam Chair, that concludes Article 2. I'll pause for any questions.
Are there questions of Ms. Griffin about Article 2? Again, Mr. Wirth, am I missing? I don't see any hands.
No hands at this time, Madam.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to Article 3, this is the Affordable Housing Eligibility Article. This article contains various amendments to programs that are related to affordable housing. Section 1 adds federally recognized American Indian tribes in Minnesota and tribal housing corporations to the entities to whom grants for affordable housing may be made in a natural disaster area. Section 2 authorizes MHFA to provide support to increase the capacity of entities to meet affordable housing needs. Section 3 eliminates the requirement under the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program that a community-based nonprofit organization have a sponsoring resolution from each of the county boards located within its operating jurisdiction. Section 4 adds counties to the list of entities that may receive home ownership development grants under the Workforce and Affordable Homeownership Development Program. Section 5 adds a federally recognized tribal reservation to the definition of eligible project area for purposes of the Workforce Housing Development Program. And Section 6 clarifies that MHFA cannot award a grant or deferred loans under the Workforce Housing Development Program to an eligible project area without certification that the amount of the grant or deferred loans will be matched. Madam Chair, that concludes the overview of Article 3. I'll pause for any questions.
I see no hands. I think we can proceed.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to Article 4, this is the Housing Finance Technical and Conforming Changes article. This contains the technical and conforming changes from MHFA. Section 1 eliminates language referencing family income requirements for purposes of community land trusts in a property tax statute. And Section 2 amends the income limitation under the definition of persons and families of low and moderate income to 115% of the greater of state median income or area or county median income. Madam Chair, that concludes Article 4. I'll pause for any questions.
Questions on Article 4? Again, seeing no hands, please proceed.
Okay, moving on to Article 5. This is the bonding provisions article, and this article contains provisions that relate to the Minnesota Bond Allocation Act, which is under Chapter 474A. Section 1 clarifies that any fees collected by Minnesota Management and Budget under the Minnesota Bond Allocation Act must be deposited in a separate account in the Special Revenue Fund. And Section 2 requires MMB to refund application deposit money to issuers that returned all of their bonding authority allocation from the 2020 housing pool to avoid a double bond fee due to the circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic. Madam Chair, that concludes Article 5. I'll pause for any questions.
And I see no hands. Mr. Wirth, I'm assuming you'll just always interrupt if I've missed anyone. I think no hands, please proceed.
Okay, Madam Chair, that concludes my a portion of the overview. I'll now turn it over to my colleague, Mary Mullen.
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, this is Mary Mullen with House Research. I am gonna walk through the last two articles of the bill, Article 6 and Article 7. Article 6 starts on page 25, and it deals with residential rental housing policy. Section 1 removes requirements that a service dog has to have an identification from a recognized school for service animals. Section 2 clarifies that a service animal doesn't have to wear physical identification about its training, and that it can be an unfair discriminatory practice for the owner of housing to deny a person with disabilities the use of a service animal. And it also removes language related to the persons the section applies to. Section 3 provides new guidelines on when the court can order a discretionary expungement of an eviction action. Section 4 provides additional situations where the court needs to grant a mandatory expungement on eviction. These include when the tenant prevailed on the merits of the case and when the court dismissed the landlord's petition. Section 5 is technical changes that correspond to eviction cases that go with Section 4. Section 6 is the service animal bill, and it provides that landlords, it allows landlords to request supporting documents related to the tenant's disability when needed, when they need a support animal. And it provides that landlords can't charge additional fees or rent for the service or support animal. It also provides that it's illegal to misrepresent that an animal you have is a service or support animal if it's not, and it provides penalties. Section 7 prohibits a landlord from imposing ongoing fees that don't relate to a service provided by the landlord, and then it imposes a penalty for violating this section. Section 8 removes a provision from existing law that allows a tenancy at will to be terminated with 14 days notice. A tenancy at will is most often a tenancy without a written lease. And so the tenant would need to use the amount of notice based on their periodic rent payment, if that's monthly, or 3 months, whichever is less. Section 9 requires a landlord to provide heat in a residential tenancy at a minimum temperature of 68 degrees from October 1st to April 30th. Section 10 restricts landlords' entry into a residential unit. They can only come in between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., and it clarifies they need to give 24 hours notice before entry, and Section 11 provides the penalties related to that section. Section 12 provides that tenant screening reports should not report on eviction cases where the tenant was not evicted, and it requires the tenant screening service to use current court records for reporting. If the tenant provides those to them, they need to update it within 24 hours. Section 13 allows a tenant to recover damages, costs, and attorney's fees if there's a violation of the tenant screening report requirements by the statute. Section 14 allows a tenant to terminate a lease if the tenant acquires assistance with daily living, such as going to a nursing care facility, if they have a disability related to mental illness, if they're entering a nursing home, hospice care, a licensed boarding care facility, adult foster care. So this is the infirmity bill. Section 15 requires tenants in certain public housing units to be appointed counsel for assistance in eviction cases. Section 16 and 17 provide that in an eviction for non-payment of rent, a landlord has to provide notice to a tenant that provides the amount due and information about how to get assistance to pay their rent and legal assistance. It requires landlords to give the tenants 14 days notice to pay the amount owed or to vacate the unit. And if the tenant doesn't do those, it allows the landlord to bring an eviction action. It provides notice under this section as a qualifying event for emergency assistance. And it provides an eviction action is not accessible to the public until the court has entered a final judgment in the case. Section 18 allows a tenant to answer a complaint orally instead of filing an answer. And it provides various ways the court can move forward on an action. It provides that the parties will comply with reasonable discovery requests, and it prohibits the court from requiring the defendant to pay a bond or pay money into court before the matter has been adjudicated. Section 19 provides a remedy for coming back to court to enforce a settlement agreement in housing court cases. Section 20 allows the court to provide relief, the relief in Section 504B.425, which includes directing either the tenant or landlord to remedy a violation and allowing rent to be used to remedy a violation through rent escrow. Section 21 allows the tenant in eviction action to appeal an order, denying a motion to vacate judgment in the same manner as a party in any other civil action. Section 22 updates requirements in notices provided to tenants when a writ of recovery is being issued. Sections 23, 24, and 25 remove references in various sections related to a portion of statute being repealed by this bill. 26 allows an unlawful exclusion cases, which is where a tenant's been locked out of the unit, to be brought for the same. 27 specifies the type of incidents that allow a tenant to petition for emergency repair in a residential unit. Those are already sort of spelled out in statute, but this gives a more specific list of times when that relief can be requested. Section 28 allows a tenant to petition for emergency relief to fix an emergency repair, and it allows the court to order a landlord immediately remedy that, and it requires to provide notice of a hearing and an ex parte petition in order as soon as practical. Section 29 relates to that those emergency repair cases, and it allows the court to charge a conciliation court filing fee for those cases. Section 30 repeals the existing statute on continuances and special appeals where eviction or termination of lease cases where a bond is provided in the appeals case. And Section 31 provides effective dates for a few portions of this article related specifically to tenants' rights. Those sections would be effective on August 1st, 2021, and apply to actions filed on or after that date. So that completes Article 6. I can pause if anyone has questions on that article.
I think I see no hands at this point for that article, so you may proceed.
Okay, Chair and members, Mary Mullen again. This is Article 7. This is relates to manufactured housing, and it begins on page 44 of the Delete Everything Amendment. Section 1 provides a process to affix a manufactured home to real property when the park that the home is located in is owned by a nonprofit cooperative. So this process allows a manufactured home to be considered an improvement to real property, and it's no longer personal property. This process is similar to how you might affix a home to real property that isn't in a, that is on a piece of land that you own. Section 2 repeals the existing process to put to make a manufactured home an improvement to real property and replaces it with a new section. So you can already affix a manufactured home to real property. This is updating the statute, so it's repealing the old one and inserting a new one. It allows a manufactured home to be made an improvement to real property when it's affixed to real property, similar to existing statute. It removes a requirement that the entire year's taxes be paid before you can do the affidavit of affixation. It allows an owner to request in writing to cancel the certificate of title to the manufactured home, but unlike current law, it doesn't require the owner to surrender the original title, but it does still require security interests to be released or satisfied prior to that. It updates the form that they use, the statutory form, and it instructs the revisor to change the statutory references to this new statute. Section 3 is a clarifying change related to Section 1 and Section 2. Section 4 is the opportunity to purchase bill. It requires the owner of a manufactured home park to provide notice to the residents in the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency 60 days before accepting an offer on the property. And it provides that a representative of the residents of the manufactured home park can submit an offer within 60 days after the notice if the park owner doesn't accept the offer. It requires the parties to negotiate in good faith. And it provides a number of changes to the process related to the negotiation and remedies if the park owner violates provisions in this section. Section 5 repeals the existing process to make a manufactured home an improvement to real property. So that goes along with Section 2, where it's been replaced. Section 6 provides that the current law governing the notice of sale of a manufactured home park is repealed. So that goes along with Section 4, which is providing a new process. And Section 7, this section repeals the existing process to make a manufactured home park an improvement to real property. And that is all of Article 7. So if you have any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions of Ms. Mullen? Clarifying questions of Ms. Mullen. I'm not seeing hands. In addition to the DE1, which they've just gone over, I will have one other author's amendment in one case, a member of the public who has already made a suggestion that we incorporated. Who would be, Ms. Mullen, are you the person who can give the overview of the A1 author's amendment that I'll also offer tomorrow?
Chair and members, I think that Ms. Griffin would do the first part of that, and then okay. I think I have a few pieces right at the end.
Okay, Ms. Griffin?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and members. Again, for the record, Chelsea Griffin, House Research. So walking through the first part of this amendment, the amendment instruction starting on line 1.3, it deletes the current writer in the DE amendment for the naturally occurring affordable housing program. This amendment actually codifies that program into Chapter 462A. So now the writer would reference the statute. And then if you look at, the start of the amendment instruction is on line 1.21, and then most of the language is on page 2 of the amendment. This is the language for the naturally occurring affordable housing program as codified into a new section 462A.40. And then the amendment instructions on line 1.8 through 1.20, this incorporates the language of section 1 of House File 1634, which is the Homes for All bill. This language amends the housing infrastructure bond statute and adds a new authorized use of housing infrastructure bonds, and then also states some preferential criteria for MHFA. And the reason it's done this way is because the bill already includes a section that amends the housing infrastructure bond statute. And so we're just merging this language into the DE amendment. And then I'll turn it over to Mary Mullen to go over the final instructions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, the last couple instructions, the very first one deletes the word before in an effective date, which just means that that's related to landlord-tenant law, that provision. And so it would only apply to situations at the time the bill passed or in the future. It wouldn't apply to previous situations. And the next one is a very technical change. In that section, I used the term defendant over and over again. And then in one spot, I used the word individual, and I wanted to make it consistent. So that's just a technical change.
Thank you very much. That will be an additional author's amendment offered tomorrow. Any other clarifying questions of any of the three of Mr. Savory or Ms. Griffin or Ms. Mullen? We also, by the way, have Lael Robertson on. Should you have a technical question about how this plays out for Minnesota, for the agency, for Minnesota Housing? I see no hands. Mr. Wirth, am I missing anyone?
Madam Chair, there are no hands up right now.
Members, we wanted to give plenty of opportunity for members and the public to hear and get an understanding of the entire bill so that as you think about whether there are further amendments needed, you would have time to do that. I think with no other questions, the plan is tomorrow, public testimony. We already have requests from quite a number of members of the public who want to testify, and then we'll consider amendments. And as I said, you have until 5 p.m. today to submit any amendments for consideration tomorrow. You have plenty of time for a break before our session begins at noon. So this, I think, will give everyone a chance to be ready for session at noon. I'm just checking once more. No other requests for clarifying comments today. So in that case, our next meeting will be tomorrow, Wednesday, April 7 at 10:30 a.m. A Zoom link should already be on your calendar, we'll look forward to the public testimony and the amendments that we'll consider. With no other business, we are adjourned.